My name is Dag Øystein Ensjø, or just Dag, and I'm an associate professor at University of Bergen in religious studies, and I'm also the leader of Menneskerettsalliansen, the Norwegian Human Rights Alliance, which is an alliance of 12 human rights organizations concentrating on various discrimination grounds like sexual orientation, gender identity, and disability, gender, and ethnicity.
And these organizations are Norwegian or?
Yeah, they're all Norwegians.
They're all Norwegian.
Yeah. So we. So that kind of connects also with what I'm doing with both scholarly and politically with the gay issue, because here in Norway, as in many other countries, we had something like various scales in the legal system, you know, if you discriminated, you get more protection if it's discriminated on the ground of gender, then on the ground of ethnicity, then on the ground of disability, then on the ground of sexual orientation, and so on.
There's like a hierarchy.
And when I started going into the gay, and the whole point is, you know, that from a human rights perspective, this is all connects to discrimination. And, you know, it's the act of discrimination is a problem, not the people who are discriminated against. So you can't, but you can't then say that, oh, this kind of discrimination is qualitatively more serious than the other one. There's no ground for doing that from the human rights regimes. When I started to go into the gay movement, we were doing fights by fight by fight. It was like a battle for every little thing. It was like, and then the politician said, oh, we are so liberal, we are so, you know, wonderful, we're going to give you this little thing. So when I started, you know, to write and go into organization politics, I said, no, that's no good. We're going to keep on forever. And this is not right. This is not the politicians are not nice to us. This is hypocrisy from their point of view. They're not giving us rights. They just stop taking the rights away from us. And we're not going to settle anymore for just little nitbits. We're not going to keep on having battle after battle after battle. We're going to go to the big war. We're going to say, we don't want all these neighbors. We want everything. We want marriage, and we want every part of government who works with equal rights to work with sexual orientation. When I first took up this marriage thing, we had, you know, civil union. The gay research was very good, and getting civil unions, which was, you know, very narrowly accepted by the parliament in 1993. But after that, there was nothing about marriage. And even the leader, then leader of the gay organization, LLH, criticized me for marriage. He didn't want marriage. And I said, you know, it's like, this is not, it's not, this, because he said, I don't want to be like that with sexual. And I said, well, that's not up to you. If you don't want to be heterosexuals, you can have a marriage, you can have, you know, a historical marriage, make it into a parody, whatever you want. But the thing is, you know, you can't use that as a rule to deny anyone equal rights. That's the whole point. We don't want different rights. We don't want, you know, separate but equal. That's not equal. So that's the whole point. And also, when, you know, I went into this, I very soon discovered that what goes for gays and lesbians goes for everybody else. You know, when we say, you know, we're not going to take it anymore and just be giving little nibbles out of, you know, of all these rights that are taken away from us. We want the whole thing. That goes for everybody else. That's the whole logical thing. So that's why I initiated this alliance then in 2004.
So your work with this starts in 2004 as well, or you have been involved earlier on since the...
I have been involved in... I started in the political around 2001 in the gay movement. At first I did not get very much response, but I had several whole... at least two whole pages in... national newspaper, Dagbladet, about marriage, you know, how, you know, because it was, I first reacted, you know, we had this then finance, Minister of Finance, who had a civil union, and everybody said, oh, how wonderful, Norway treats gays equal, you know, we are, you know, so liberal, and everybody looks at us, we are, you know, the beacon of homosexual liberation. I said, fuck that, you're not, we're not, these are, you know, these are defined as worth less than any straight couple. And then, some months after that, I wrote a whole piece just saying that the civil union is just a parenthesis, and telling, you know, point to point, you know, how this goes to equal rights and how we are, you know, should argue. And this was picked up then by the socialist left party, Mai Hansen, or I don't remember her other name. She was a very important lesbian parliament member of parliament then, and they picked this up and proposed it at in parliament, and then the process started, and it was, you know, then when it became a center left government. They picked up this proposal and worked on it.
So your work or your form of activism has been in the form of writing in that regard?
Mostly, but also, you know, I have been in the organization as well, okay, arguing this stuff. And actually, I've been very much inspired by American point of view, especially, you know, just the existence of Human Rights Council and their symbol, you know, the equal sign, was a very much awakener for me, because I just realized this is human rights. This is, you know, this is not special rights. This is just human rights. It's just that these human rights are kept away from us, as there are for so many other people. And that's what I try to do, you know, bring this thinking to Norway. And so that is most important. And now most people, politicians, now do talk about human rights, which is very good. They don't talk about, you know, gay rights, you know, all these poor little gays who have to be helped because, you know, they're so depressed and have so miserable lives and we have to do something to help them. That was the argument before, ordinary. Now it's more, you know, human rights, and you see them all over the place.
There still seems to be a critical take on this emphasis on respectability and family values from some academics that are interested in queer studies and queer issues. How did you reconcile perhaps your interest in this with using the issue of marriage as a kind of political strategy?
I have to show you something. Here. This I wrote together with some other people in, when was it? 2001. This was one of the first things I did. It's called Sick of Gender / Sex. It's the same word in Norway, you know, not the sexual activity, but, you know, the gender sex of a person. And that's the whole point. Personally, I don't... personally, I don't care at all about, you know, people's sex and gender, and my gender status is very much an aesthetic thing. I don't, my gender identity, I don't care at all. I don't care at all what people think or what they are, what I am myself. I couldn't care less. But that thing, you know, that doesn't. You can have both parts at the same time, but even though I feel that way and feel very much like a queer person, you have to respect that was the majority of people being either a man or a woman, or, you know, a trans person, is very important to their identity, and you should respect that. You can't then go on and say, oh no, your, you know, female identity or male identity is worthless. That's you know, not only rude, but you know, you're forcing them to live the way you want, and you can't do that, because then you don't have any right to keep them from forcing you to live the way they want. So I feel that these are very much the same thing, and it's like me. It's but the whole thing with Human Rights Project is that, you know, whatever rights are there for straight people, or, you know, for other discrimination grounds, but sexual orientation should be also connected with people, to gay and lesbians, and to the area of sexual orientation, just because they are there, because it's equal rights. And it's like, you know, I've argued for adoption, but I don't want children myself. So that's the whole point.
That's good. What is the relationship between this kind of attitude that you have, which seems to be a kind of instrumentalization of identity politics in a way, for achieving legislation and a kind of political change,
mm-hmm.
with the work that had already been done before you came to play a part. In mm-hmm. other words, there was a kind of active movement.
Mm-hmm.
From the 70s on, if I understand mm-hmm. correctly. How do you pick it up, and how mm-hmm. do you reconcile those mm-hmm. Similarities and differences in approach and methodology?
I stand on the shoulder of giants. I have to accept that, and that's, you know the whole thing. You know, we have to remember that male homosexuality was illegalized until 1972. When they legalized it, they tried to make, you know, different age of consent, and that was stopped. In the 50s, they stopped the government from trying to outlaw gay organizations, you know, even though that was legal, even though homosexuality by itself was legal. And, you know, the whole civil union thing, if without the civil union, we wouldn't have been able to have marriage. It was very important to have that step by step. But after 1993, after that, with Gro Lindstad, who was the leader of LLH, the movement was floundering. They didn't manage to find any. They were running from small case after another. They couldn't find a focus anymore. And so that was a challenge, and people. And everyone said, oh, we are fine. But I said, you're not fine. You're just used to being second-class citizens. And you shouldn't be used to that. You shouldn't allow people to treat you like that. So that's what I try to get into the gay movement. So, but the thing is that, interestingly, this has been the thing which has been happening now with the whole marriage thing, you know. It's not the gay organization itself, LLH, which pushed it through. It's gay politicians and their allies in their various parties. In the Socialist Left Party, formerly, then in the Labour Party, and in the Conservative Party, and in the Liberal Party, Venstre. They were the one, you know, who managed, you know, to convince their colleagues, you know, that this was the right thing and this was important.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very interesting that the gay movement never managed really to get onto this, the gay organization. what has been doing very well. It's been very well at organizing now at the local level, and they've been pushing. It was the former leader of the Oslo organization who pushed for what was called handlingsplaner, activity plans for gay, lesbian, and transgender people. And that's been very important. But when it comes to the political issue, when it comes to human rights and to the marriage thing and equal rights, they have been good in following up, but the initiative hasn't been coming from the gay organizations. And that's actually a very interesting point of view, that what has really changed here is, I think, two things. Is the whole thinking that, you know, that gay rights are not special rights but human rights, which are now more or less accepted by everybody except for the Progress Party. And that these gay and lesbian politicians in various parties have been very out and precise and in their political arguments doing this.
What do you think it's the effect of this progressive legislation on the way that people are actually living their lives out on the street? And I don't mean that the literal things like that people can marry or adopt, or but do you find that there has been a change in culture that has followed the law, and if so, how?
Yes. And the biggest change happened in 1993 with the civil union thing. Just, you know, even though it was a second class thing, because that was the only thing we could manage at that time. I wasn't involved in that, but you know, that was the only thing that could be managed. Yeah, and it was very narrowly went through Parliament, which was by one vote. That normalized it. And you have to recall, you know, no matter, you know, how many there are of us, you know, who feel like queer, and, you know, and all these people who look queer and, you know, don't, and the other people don't want to live in monogamous relationships and all that, and have very radical lives all the time. We are a minority among gay and lesbian people. Gay and lesbians are most very much like straight people. They want to have ordinary lives in the suburbs. And that's what happened, you know, with civil union. That made it so easy and so much easier to get, you know, to normalize it. And it became a flood, you know. When I grew up, we had, you know, one out famous lesbian activist, you know, Kim Friele, and then there were some rumors about some other people. There was hardly anyone. It was like, and now people, you know, come out all the time and no one cares. It's no news anymore, and it's just people are, you know, just accepting as just a normal variety. It's just like, oh, he's gay, she's gay, oh well, okay.
It is my impression, and I have no way of testing this, but from conversations with people in the streets and in bars and so on, and even in this gay network inside the gays here, it seems not to be an issue, this idea of being out or not, which is something that surprised me when I arrived here, in the sense that I figured that the following kind of behavior to this progressive legislation would be just to have an open life entirely. But it seems to be, that doesn't seem to be the case. And I've, from your colleagues that I've been talking to, also some people recognize that there is still a level of concealment. Yeah, what do you think that is about?
There is. And, you know, there are still, you know, very conservative segments of the population still, you know, if you are, you know, growing up in Muslim communities or in conservative Christian communities, of course, you know, you will carry condemnations and so on. It is no fun to come out. And it's also, you know, there's also, you know, still the expectancies, and people also have expectancies of themselves being straight, and then they find out they're not, and they at first don't like it. Or others are still, you know, worried, you know, what would other people think, you know. Kids are still beating up because they're being gay. So it's changing, you know. People now people come out in junior or high school. People didn't come out even in high school when I was young. That was unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was rumors, and you know, everybody who knew they were, like myself, you know, we just kept quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And knew that was the only feasible way.
It would be interesting for me to speak about this issue of citizenship as it relates to the influence of the church,
mm-hmm.
because and human rights, because it seems like some of the for example, the issue of discrimination is one that is left in parentheses when it comes to the church, right? They have, I mean, they, I don't know if you can say that they have the right to discriminate, but they technically do.
Mm-hmm.
How can you speak about the relationship between sex and religion in your experience?
The problem with Norway is that we have a state church, which I think is like 82% are members of. And this church, even though the government is actually free to regulate what they should believe in, if they said, you know, everybody should wear yellow hats, you know, they could enforce that. But in practice, the church still has a great deal of autonomy, and they're still allowed to discriminate against gays and women to a certain degree, as long as, you know, it, you know, connects with their original beliefs. And this is a problem because it's a state church, because you cannot regulate what the various religions believe. You can't, you know, you can't have Catholic Church hire heterosexual active male priests or any women priest, you know, because it's against their, you know, dogma. But the thing is, you know, as long as you have a state church which discriminate, you have discrimination with state sanction. And you also have to give money to these other churches and other religious communities, which are even worse, as long as, you know, they are, you know, homophobic, racist, whatever they are, because our state churches. So that's a problem.
I imagine this propagates a kind of religious ethic to all other aspects of society in relationship to this subject, or not?
Yes, in two ways. There's, of course, there's the traditional Christian anti-sexual arguments, which now are mostly focused on gays and lesbians. You know, whatever straight people do or don't do are more or less forgotten. And the whole focus are on this little minority of gays and lesbians, which, you know, is a great thing because for the Christians, because then everyone can feel so great when you just, you know, harass the gays and lesbians. So it's great to hate. And, you know, go after minorities always makes you feel better. So there's that thing. And there's also still, you know, just a general sense of homophobia in parts of the population, which are connected historically to the religious tradition, but are not really religiously based now, which is just as like there's racism in Norway, and you know, but then you can hide behind, you know, all Christian rules and say, you know, we don't like gays and lesbians because of, you know, you can have the Christian excuse and still be allowed to hate, which is, of course, give yourself a great feeling to, you know, diminish other people, and you can feel so much better yourself.
What is the history of the relationship between sex and religion in this country from, or the modern history of this country, if you can delineated, say for example since the 50s on, and has the attitude changed in relationship to the advances in legislation and
yes.
In terms of social movements?
Yes, it's changed very much. You have to remember that it was not only male homosexuality which was legalized in 1972, it was also straight cohabitation. It was illegal until 1972 for a man and a woman who was not in relation to each other, relatives or married, to live together. And so this is a gradual thing. Norway was one of the first countries in the world to stop discriminating children born out of wedlock. But you know, that was an important first step. And now most children in Norway are born out of wedlock. You know, most people get their children, at least the first children, before they marry. They cohabit and then they marry afterwards. Or maybe marry someone else afterwards. So it's been a revolution, definitely a revolution. So it's been a gradual one, and you know, and it was the whole, you know, there's various factors here. There is, you know, general loosening of the religious grip, which, you know, wants us to live in a certain way sexually. It's been the legislation, which has been, you know, more and more to a point of view that let people do whatever they want to do, as long as they don't hurt each other. There's also been, you know, the liberation movement, you know, first the women movement and then the gay movement. And then there also been, you know, from a straight point of view, you know, contraceptives have been extremely, you know, just a pill, been extremely important. You know, now you can sleep around, you don't have to worry about children if you're straight.
What is the relationship of the church to other forms of diverse sexualities, such as transgender issues or intersex individuals and subjects? Is this something that is debated in that discourse at all, or?
It's very much silenced. And when it comes to gender identity, there's different variety. When it comes to transsexuals, you know, who wants to correct their gender surgically, they have come a very long way, and they're interestingly have a very good relationship with the Christian Democrats Party, which are been definitely very anti-gay all the way through. But you know, they accept these transsexuals who wants to, you know, change gender legally completely to become, you know, ordinary man. Well, some of them are, you know, ending up as lesbians and gays and bisexual anyway, but that's not what they argue. So they have come a long way. When it comes to other transgender people, when it comes to gender identity, like transvestites and intersex, that's very much not an issue. We have one very famous person who is called Espen Ester Pirelli Benestad, who does a very great job to put a face on this. And the All Transvestite organization, which is now a transgender organization, also open for transsexuals, are one of the organizations in the Human Rights Alliance. I work with them. And it's been a point of view. We are now trying to get, you know, gender identity and expression also as a discrimination ground into the legal sphere. This is the whole anti-discrimination laws now are being revised in this very moment. Is a process going on now, which we are very much in. But I think the visibility here is very much, I remember when, you know, we had an equal rights gender law for a quarter of a century, and then it was going to be an anti-racist law. And I went there for the Human Rights Alliance and also said, okay, come here, you know, the transsexual organization, you should come here. And we went to Parliament at the public hearing then, and we were very confused. It was like, well, this is about racism. Why are they here? And they stood up and said, you know, hello, we are from, you know, the National Organization for Transsexuals. We have no protection whatsoever in the last Norwegian legal against discrimination. And now we're going to tell how this that is. And that was an eye-opener. That was a very important eye-opener. So there have been very, in such a case, there have been important, you know, to open up the political eyes, people who really works on this, you know, that when it comes to discrimination, you always have to look at the margins to see, you know, really look for those you don't think about, because that's where the real discrimination is going on, that's those who don't have any protection in the law whatsoever. So there's a movement going on there, but you know, there's still, you know, we're now gonna have our annual meeting at the Human Rights Alliance with the various organizations, and there's a problem from the transgender organization, the former transvestite organization, to have a person coming, because the one who usually come cannot come. And they have problems because even people at the board find it difficult even to come at such a meeting. You know, people are so closeted still when it comes to gender identity.
Oh, you mean they're afraid to come out in that sense?
Yeah. Even at, you know, a meeting where everybody, you know, are very positive, you know, just to show themselves, you know.
So there is just a few public faces and...
Very few. Even, you know, people still in the closet and in sitting at the board of a national organization. So when it comes to gender identity, it's very much a closet thing.
Is there a relationship with the church, or an opinion of the church in relationship to this issue?
When it comes to the anti-marriage movement, very many of them are very much about... When you look at the argument, they talk about, you know, gender roles, and they're very worried about, you know, gender roles being confused. But the gender minorities in Norway are so invisible. So even though these conservative Christians probably, you know, hate the very idea of, you know, all these transgender people, they don't even seem to be aware of them. But they probably find them soon.
Mm-hmm. Also, what is the, from the perspective of the church, what is the, because the effects of this, the Marriage Act and the Civil Union Act and so on, are quite tangible in changing society at large, in the sense that it produces new forms of family relations, new forms of parenthood and so on and so forth. What is the church's position in regards to this?
There's been a revolution. In 1993, almost all religious organizations was completely against the Civil Union Acts. The only exception was the Quakers and the Unitarians. Now, last year, when this was debated in Parliament, and you know, there was all these official hearings, nearly all the religious communities who had, you know, their official hearings, responses on this, were pro-civil unions. They recognized, you know, some, you know, they recognized the necessity and the rights for same-sex couples to legalize their relationships. Some said, you know, well, we don't find this in, you know, right from a Christian point of view, but that doesn't mean that we can accept that people can still be allowed to do this. And
but are they recognized as members of the church?
Yeah. Mostly, yes. In of the state church, definitely, yes. No, none have ever been thrown out of their group because of this point of view. Some of the very small conservative communities, you know, this would be a problem. But even, you know, when it comes to marriage, you know, the Unitarians and the Quakers were for marriage too, and parts of the Norwegian State Church. Two bishops was for marriage. So it has been a complete revolution in 15 years.
Interesting. To expand a little bit on that, I'm sorry, I just lost my thought. To expand a little bit on that issue is, I lost my thought entirely.
No, but one thing is very important. It's like when I started, you know, arguing, you know, for, you know, we don't want this, you know, battle by battle, you know, small, tidbit by tidbit. We want the whole thing. And we were and some politicians are against us, and I said, you know, oh, but you know, everything can't be solved by legislation. You know, this has to do with attitudes.
Right.
And I said, sure, but you know, legislation reflects attitudes, and we don't settle for anything but equal rights. Period. And you are politicians. You are the one who make the laws. So you just go on and give us equal rights. Then you can come back and talk about attitudes.
Right. I remember what I was going to ask you. Sorry, I was going to ask you if you could just briefly, for the sake of the conversation on religion, outline the pie of religions that are present in Norway and their kind of importance, meaning the different religions that are coexisting.
Well, it's 82% state, the Lutheran state church. And that is a church where everybody, more united, well, you know, most of the members, they don't go to church. Many of them don't even get baptized. Many of them don't even get confirmed. Many of them don't even get married in churches. Most of them do get buried, you know, just in case. That's the most popular option. Well, still.
You have no choice.
No, you have a choice.
Oh,
yeah, you have a choice, but you don't know, so you know. Well,
well, that's what I mean. You don't know what happens.
Yeah. So that's like the last remain is we very much have a funeral church in Norway. That's when people go to church. For the other 18%, I don't know the exact numbers, but we have a sizable Muslim minority, which are, you know, a couple hundred thousand strong. Like in this part of town, Muslims are maybe in the majority. We have various Christian, small Christian organizations, more, you know, various degrees conservatives. And we have a very small Jewish community, just around a couple of thousand. And we have, you know, the humanitarians, and we have a very, very small neo-Norse pagan, which are now just got the right to bury their own people, which is good for them. Mm-hmm.
And the attitudes in terms of gay, lesbian, transsexual issues from these various groups differ greatly, and does that matter in terms of the impact it may have on political impact it may have?
The thing is, with the interesting with the Islamic groups, they didn't say anything. They didn't have any official reactions, you know, when there was an official hearing on the marriage thing. But, you know, they are precisely anti-gay, even though, as everybody knows, there's no nothing against sex between women, either in the Quran or in the Muslim tradition. The point is that the gay lesbian youth movement and the gay movement, that's been a good thing that the gay organization has been doing, been going in dialogue with the Islamic, the National Islamic Council, which is like an umbrella of all these various Islamic branches, which are mostly nationally based. You know, if you are, you know, Pakistani or Bosnian or Somali, you would go to various mosques. And they had come, you know, to a human rights point of view, where the Islamic Council has gone out and condemned violence and discrimination against gays and lesbians. And they say, you know, this is a human right point of view. Just as we have the right as Muslims to say that, according to our beliefs, homosexuality is not right. but that is our view, and we cannot, you know, that doesn't keeps us from seeing that, you know, human rights are important. That's what keeps society together, and we have to accept that gays and lesbians have the right to live their life in peace as well.
I suppose the situation within like micro communities, to say, for example, gay and lesbian immigrant groups, and gay and lesbian undocumented immigrants, refugees, and so on and so forth, the situation in terms of citizenship must be different. And yes or no, and if so, what is the work that is being done to provide these people with rights based on sexual orientation?
The point is that, you know, they are in a much larger degree of social control than ethnic Norwegians are. In some, if not all of these, they're very different, these various immigrant communities.
So that's the whole point. What do you mean exactly by social control?
From their own, you know.
From their own community.
From their own communities and from their own families. And you know, there are greater expectations of that you should marry and so on. So that's a problem, and you know, there's so what's been doing here is that, you know, there is a organization which works especially for this Shy Verden queer world, which is doing very important work by, you know, working within the communities and, you know, making an open space for these people, because even though the gay communities are much more open and it's much easier to get into a gay community as a non-Norwegian as it is to get into another ethnic Norwegian community as a non-Norwegian, it's still, you know, they're much to much more degree closet and so on, so it's important for them to also have their own fields.
This is something I was talking with Anthony later on today. Mm-hmm. It's a question that interests me, is that I've gotten a sense that largely in Scandinavian countries, since the mainstream is a liberal attitude in relationship to gender and sexual orientation, mm-hmm. when it comes to criticizing issues of immigration and multiculturalism, there is often this very politically correct language that is used, and kind of conceptual language that is used, which often misses the point of the complexity of the situation. Do you find that this is so, and if so, how do you position yourself in relationship to this from the perspective of the Human Rights Alliance?
That has been a problem. When it comes to Human Rights Alliance, we work against the politicians. We want, you know, the equal rights thing for, you know, all discrimination grounds. That's our issue. So we don't work on the street like that. But when it comes to, he's very correct in that, but it's changing. It's been, you know, lots of misogynism, homophobic things within the various immigrant community has been to much degree, more degree, been accepted, you know, tolerated, because it's, people say, oh, it's their culture. And it's like, oh, they're minorities, you know, or they, you know, they're, you know, they can't discriminate themselves, and they have themselves within minorities, you know, it's like, oh, we're a minority, we can't do anything wrong. And that's also goes for the gay communities, you know, we have to work with ourselves. We have lots of issues here, you know, against people who are, you know, gender minorities, disabled, ethnic minorities, and so on. So that's, you have to have the same standard, you have to, you know, and that's to have the same demands on them, and that's why you have to go in there and say, you know, we're not, you should not, you know, we cannot accept, you know, families to go on and force, you know, harass their own children because they're, you know, gays and lesbians, you know. That's when, you know, community should go in and help them, just as, you know, they should go in and help other people. and so on. So
also because to speak of a an isolated community is it's not real, in the sense that multiculturalism entails the fact that there is a new generation of Norwegians which are half Pakistani and half Norwegian, for example. And, right, so there is an overlap of cultural and tradition that needs to be closely inspected as opposed to seen from afar, I imagine, yeah?
Yeah. The point is, especially when it comes to the Pakistani community, it's very much oriented towards itself, and, you know, they have a tendency to go and marry people from the region. It was a very poor region of Punjab, where it originally come from in Pakistan. So that kind of makes integration more difficult. You know, they keep some, you know, relating to this very conservative, traditional part of Pakistan, which it makes it a special issue.
To return to the issue of religion more precisely, or even to ethics more precisely, would be, what do you think is the ethical challenge at the moment with this revolution that you have named, in terms of maybe more tolerance or acceptance of sexual difference? But what is the status today, and what is the emphasis of your work at the moment?
I think it's very important to don't accept intolerance. It's very interesting. It's like, especially now this year, Fritur, the Free Speech Association, which is a very important, very wealthy organization, gave their honor, prize of honor, to this horrendous homophobic woman who, for a book she wrote, which was horribly written, was all about, you know, that gays should not have the rights to hardly anything. And all these conservative Christians came and, you know, to her defense and said, you know, oh, you know, this is so good and so on. And the point is, we just have to make it point out, this is a human rights point of view. And we should draw parallels. And when it comes to Christianity, a very important parallel is to look to Christian racism, which was very widespread, and is still widespread. You have to remember that in 1958, 94 white Americans found that marriage between blacks and whites were immoral. In year 2000, 41% in the state of Alabama voted against legalizing voted against scrapping the law that made outlawed marriage between blacks and whites. That was in the year 2000. And, you know, they're much more in the Bible and in the tradition, in the Christian tradition, that goes on Christian racism than Christian homophobia. And you should draw the parallel. And the Christians today, they hate it. And they get horribly upset. But it is so right, and it's so correct. They need that mirror. They have to say, it's like, well, we accept your right to be homophobic within your own Christian community, just as we accept other Christians' rights and other religious rights to be racist within their own religious communities. And these people get just vivid. And because when it comes to racism now, it's become so far beyond what's you know, politically correct. Like when it was that referendum in Alabama in the year 2000, it was hardly anyone except for a few congressmen who argued, you know, against for keeping that law. But when it came to the polls, 41% still voted for it. So, you know, when it comes to the political correctness of racism, it's not accepted at all. And that's what we should say. Well, it's the same homophobia. It's exactly the same thing. It's exactly the same thing from a religious point of view. Just look at the Bible. It's so much more written about written about racism and, you know, Christian and Jewish demands for racism. The Bible has no story about God killing anyone because of homosexuality. We have to remember that, you know, the story of Sodom and Gomorrah doesn't connect really to homosexuality in the first place. If it refers to hospitality, the lack of hospitality, you're not supposed to rape your guests. And that's why, you know, for wanting to rape your guests, that's why God destroyed those two cities originally. But on the way, and in the Exodus, in the desert, and this is from the book of Numbers, chapter 25, God's killed 20,000 Israelites for, you know, for having sex with Moabite women. And the thing that stops them is that this one priest, Pinhas is called, kills one of these anti-racistic couples. And then, you know, God's anger subsides. So that's what Christians should be told again and again, and don't let them forget it. Whenever they take up homophobia, take up racism and say, okay, I see, it's the same thing. And it's exactly the same thing because, especially because it's so sexually loaded. And the most important thing, Christian racism was the sexual aspect. The most important thing was to keep them from sexual integration. Like when the Bob Jones University in South Carolina in 1999, you know, they refused this guy for a professorship because he was married to a black woman, and as they said, you know, well, all God's plans indicates that, you know, it's best for the races not to mix. So the sexual issue of Christian racism is so parallel that everybody should use it and everybody should know it, and all these Christian homophobes should know it too.
Is that what you're writing about at the moment?
I use it very much in my Sex and Religion book, which I just published. So, and I also had some things in the newspapers about it. And, you know, when she got the prize, I said, well, so now we're going to, you know, celebrate homophobia. So why don't we celebrate racism next year? You know, it's very brave to go out and say, you know, to talk and defend racism. No one dares to do that. That's really something daring to do. So if you want to, you know, give someone a prize for being daring, you should give to some racist next year. Mm. And the Christian conservatives got extremely upset and said, oh, no, you can't compare this, but you can very well compare this.
So do you consider that that is the strategy to tackle that that change in a way?
I think it's just very important just to not let them get away with it. Don't make them think that Christians fight against homosexuality, it's something unique. It connects, it's a complete parallel to the sexual racist fight that had been fighting for centuries.
I mean, because, for example, in the case of the Proposition 8 situation in California, in the mm-hmm. United States, it was primarily the Mormons that organized against it with mm-hmm. huge mobilization, economic support, and so on. And then the worst thing also is that based on this kind of moral and ethical discourse mm-hmm. that they were pushing, they brought it to the polls.
Mm-hmm.
And it clearly failed in the polls as well, in mm-hmm. a kind of similar situation mm-hmm. than what you just mentioned.
But I should have brought up that also in the California thing, especially when it comes to when with Mormonism, which, you know, didn't allow black priests until 1978.
Right.
Because according to Mormonism, you know, black skin color, was originally the sign of Cain, the mark of Cain, you know, when God cursed Cain, he made him black. And, you know, when the Jews, according to the Mormon beliefs, who went to America before Jesus, the lost tribes of Israel, when they, you know, lost their true faith, you know, they also was, you know, punished by getting a dark skin color, becoming, you know, Native Americans. And of course, there's also the whole, and Mormonism also have had this very much this denial that you shouldn't, you know, this non-acceptance for marriage across the color line.
What is so threatening about homosexuality and or diverse sexualities and identities to the church?
I think it goes very much to gender identity, because, you know, it's so important. You know, what's the most important thing about being a man and being a woman? It's, you know, procreate. Marrying a person of a different gender, opposite gender.
And procreate also?
Well, if you can. Some cannot, so, you know, you can't help that, but still, you know, try to procreate. You should do that at least. So, you know, so when people go on and want to marry someone of the same sex, you know, the whole gender identity thing flounders, and it comes, you know, this connects, you know, the whole thing with natural as a human identity. But it's also, you know, as it says, let's say on American Dad, gays are the new blacks. It's always great to have someone to hate, and, you know, and gays are such a visible minority. You know, there's other, you know, people who are sexual deviant from this conservative Christian point of view, like divorcees and so on. But they don't, you know, they don't go around talking about, you know, being the divorcee. They don't go have a divorcee pride and stuff like that. Homosexuals are a very easy target. It's just like, you know, well, Jews, blacks, whatever. You always go after someone, and you see that, you know, there's always, you know, all this new minorities before people comes to the point of accepting them. They're always, you know, targets. You see that especially now with homeless in America, which is now targeted of hate crimes all over the nation.
I imagine for because of the your interest in your research, the case of the United States now in relationship to gay marriage must be quite interesting. What is your take on it? Because it's so much based on this moral battle.
The thing is, I think the gay lesbian movement in the US have been doing it very right. They've been doing the human rights point of view, or, you know, in America, you talk about civil rights instead of human rights, that's more, but it's the same thing. And they talk about equal rights, and they've been, you know, they don't go into morals and just talk about equal rights, civil rights, you know, and you look, you know, what's the consequences of all this discrimination, you know, being, you know, not being able to visit your loved one when he or she is dying, you know, losing your children, all these horrible things. I think they're doing very well, and the only thing that they should do more is to pull up the race issue more.
Equivalence.
Yeah, they should do it much more. And they have also, you remember the Loving versus Virginia, which, you know, the case in 1967, Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court put all these laws on hold, like in Alabama, even though they kept the law on paper until 2000, against, you know, marriage between different races, interracial marriages. The woman, Loving, she just died last year, and she said, you know, she connected also to gay marriage. She said, you know, I believe, you know, everybody should be able to marry whoever they want, regardless of color, religion, or gender.
That's something quite devastating in the last general election in the United States, is the fact that the queer and gay and lesbian community was clearly supporting Obama.
Mm-hmm.
But when it came to Proposition 8, it was the black community that also prevented it from occurring. It was a backlash.
Mm-hmm.
It was really not a kind of a
mm-hmm.
unity in that regard.
I think that's why the work we're doing in Human Rights Alliance here is important. because we're using mirrors, and it's very important, you know, especially when it comes to ethnic minorities in Norway, because they are some of them are often, you know, the targets of racism. And they complain rightly about it, and they should, because racism is not acceptable. And then they turn around and they go are homophobic themselves. And you should use mirrors here too and say, you know, it's like, well, your whole logic, your whole argument for or against racism falls apart if you are homophobic yourself. You can't, you know. Why should people stop being racist if you're homophobic? It's the same thing.
Because they don't consider it's quite the same.
But that's, you know, from a human rights point of view, it's exactly the same.
Yeah.
And that's what you should use. And, you know, and that's what it used very cleverly now by the, especially the gay, lesbian, the queer youth movement, and also the gay, lesbian organization with the Islamic Council, which also connects to things I've written before, you know, that they realize that, you know, that we have to accept people's right to be homosexual just as we accept people's right to be Muslim.